Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. How are you today,
hello.
Mom?
Hello. I'm good. And it's a beautiful day to hear. Another beautiful day.
It's going to get hot, though, isn't it?
Hey, this is Iowa.
I can't believe we had 100 degree in May this year. That was just not acceptable.
No, it's not. Well, we had two lovely days the first part of this week, though, that were cool and windy, and
that's
oh my
true.
Goodness, it was really
something. And it
rained
last night, so maybe it won't get quite so hot today.
I don't think it rained here.
Talking about
anyway.
Summer, we've got the perfect summer book, don't we?
Yes, we do. We do. Summer Hours at the Robbers Library, an interesting title and an interesting book as well.
And this book is by Sue Halpern. You want to tell the listeners a little bit about Sue?
Okay. Sue is the author most recently of A Dog Walked into a Nursing Home, which I got to read. And her journalism and criticism have appeared in Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, New York Review of Books, and the Condé Nast Traveler, among other publications. She is a scholar in residence at Middlebury College, where she runs the Narrative Journalism Fellowship. She was a Rhodes Scholar and a Guggenheim Fellow, and is married to the writer and activist Bill McKibben. So this is a very interesting book, and I highly recommend it. You can't put it down. You really can't.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Sue.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, tell me a little bit about your career as a writer, because you've written both fiction and nonfiction. Have you crossed the genres quite a bit?
You know, I've written 3 books of fiction and 4 books of nonfiction, and I spend a lot of my time writing journalism, doing journalism, because it's quick and it's kind of fun. And it's good to work on a deadline as opposed to when you're writing a novel and, you know, time will expand for as long as you need it to expand for, which can be, forever. So I like doing both. I find them very different muscles, but really, both very, very satisfying and both really hard.
Well, as a scholar, what drew you to writing fiction?
You know, I started out by writing fiction, and I've always done this kind of dual thing, even when I was in college. So it didn't strike me as being very odd. I think that some people think that it's odd, but I mean, and a scholar is maybe a little too much. It's like too hoity-toity a term. It's just kind of the term that they give me here at Middlebury College. but it's not like I'm sitting there, you know, writing some incredible
A Rhodes Scholar. That's pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean,
come on, this is brainiac stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there is a certain pointy-headedness to the whole endeavor, I would agree, except that's why journalism and nonfiction writing I find really much more satisfying than, say, academic work. And so I did get a PhD, and I did teach very briefly at a college or two, and then realized I had this revelation one day that I really didn't want to be writing stuff that only a few people would read. I really wanted to write things that mattered and that had a wide audience. And so that meant not writing, you know, for academic journals, and it meant for writing for popular magazines for the most part. And that segued into writing books, longer pieces. So it really was this attempt on my part to kind of abandon the kind of elitism and, you know, arcane ways that academics work and kind of move into the world that we mostly inhabit, that most of us inhabit.
So where did the idea behind Summer Hours at the Robbers Library come from?
It kind of came from two different, very different places. The first one was, so the Robbers Library is a book that's set in a library, and its main character, Kit, is a librarian. And that came about because I was living for years in a very small, very rural, and very poor community in the Adirondack Mountains of New York State. So far, far upstate New York, kind of near Canada. Very hard scrabble, very hard to farm, very hard for people to make a living. There was a lot of logging and a lot of people working at kind of seasonal jobs. And there was no library. And the town had been served by a bookmobile, and the bookmobile went out of business. And it was no longer able to make it up those roads, especially in the winter, and the Regional Library Consortium sort of took it out of circulation, and so we had no access to books. And there was a guy in our town who was on our town board, he worked in the lumberyard, and he was just really adamant that we do something, that we have some kind of access to the outside world, because it was a very isolated place. And he managed to find in the town budget $15,000, and he asked three of us, or the town board asked three of us, me and these two retired teachers, to take that $15,000 and make a library for our town out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that. It took a lot of ingenuity and a lot of luck and a lot of magic, and it happened. And it changed, it transformed the town. It literally transformed the town. And that library, which was in the back of Town Hall and still is in the back of Town Hall, at the time when we started it, we had 3,000 borrowed books from the library consortium. Now that library is four rooms, and it has 40,000 articles in it, and almost everybody in that town has a library card. So there was this sense that libraries were transformative both to communities and to individuals. So that was kind of in my mind. And there was a second thing that I had found really interesting when I was doing a piece for The New Yorker. And I came across this statistic, which really surprised me. I was doing a story about, veterans who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan and various therapies that were being used to help them overcome PTSD. But in the course of that, I read the statistic that kind of blew me away, which was that 2 years after people who had been through some kind of major physical trauma, typically an event that caused them to lose the use of their legs, so they became paraplegics, spinal cord injury, 2 years after that, they reported that their lives were better than they had been prior to, which kind of shocked me. But then I continued to look into that, and I found that, in fact, in a lot of cases, when people go through really, really tough times and they come through the other side, they report that they have better life satisfaction, and they report that they kind of appreciate things in their world much more than they ever had, because they're much more aware of them. And so that led me to this idea that it would be interesting to write about someone who's going through something tough, and was, very incrementally going through it and coming out the other end. And I thought it would be much more satisfying to do that as fiction rather than to do it as nonfiction, because it's really hard to talk to people in the process, because when they're going through it, they don't know what's going to happen at the other end. And if you talk to them at the other end, you really don't know what the process was like. And so I wanted to imagine what that process was like and watch as Kit, the main character in this librarian, comes out the other side.
And of course, the other two main characters in the book are going through their own traumatic experiences.
Exactly. And so, that's something I think that's true to the human experience. I mean, everyone goes through tough times and things that are hard for them. In this case, Rusty, who's the guy who shows up at the library, has lost his job because of the economic downturn, and you know, his whole life was kind of built around his work, and really was built around making money because he was one of those banker types. And then the third character is this young girl named Sunny, who has grown up kind of off the grid with her hippie parents, and who's really trying to figure out where she belongs, but it's really hard because her parents are so much who they are. And Sunny ends up in the orbit of Kit, and is really the catalyst for Kit getting better, for her coming out of herself.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Did you have the title in mind when you first started doing the plot for this book?
No. That is funny that you would say that. I didn't at all. And, in fact, I didn't have a title. And I finished the book, and I gave it to my agent, and the agent sold it to my editor. And there was no title. And I honestly think it took almost as long to write the book as it did to come up with a title. It was just a struggle. Two people, so there were three of us kind of in on this, and, you know, two people would like an idea and the third one wouldn't, and we were sort of at the point where we really wanted all three of us to be excited about it, and I kind of wanted them to be really excited about it because, you know, they were the ones, particularly my editor, were the ones who were going to have to go out and get other people excited about it. So it was a bit of a slog, and it was kind of hysterical because pretty much every day, you know, I'd get an email from one or the other of them, or I would send them an email like, here's a new idea, and like invariably by the end of the day they would all be shut down. So
well, what did you call this as you were working on it? You must have had something that you, some way that you,
yeah,
referred to it.
I did. I did. I there was a poem that I really like, and it's in the book. It's a poem by Elizabeth Bishop called One Art. And there's a line in there, and it says, lose something every day. And I really like that line. So that's, I would call it that, or I would just say, you know, LSED was sort of how I put it in my folder. But no one liked that. They thought it was like too much of a downer, and the book is kind of funny and sweet, and they just thought, you know, that sort of sounded like, you know, if you read this book, you probably would need some Prozac at the end of it.
Well, you know, actually, it reminded me of Sunny, because she was a robber, and sort of, and she,
yeah,
had to do summer hours, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So that's really funny, because I wasn't really thinking about Sunny when I wrote that title. I was really thinking about the library. But a few weeks ago, people who are publishing this book in Italy sent over their cover for what it's going to look like when it comes out there. And they changed the title to something like The Thief in the Library. And I was like, what? Huh? And they were like, well, Sunny is a thief. She's in the library. So it's going to be called,
yeah,
The Thief in the Library. And my agent here was like, well, that's really weird. And I was like, well, you know, if that's how they read it, you know, more power to them.
Yeah.
Remind me why this library was referred to as the Robber's Library.
So this library is in a town in New Hampshire that was a thriving mill town. I don't know if you guys can sort of imagine this since you're out in Iowa, but in the 18th and 19th century, these towns in New England that were on water, and this was on a river, were big mill towns because they could, you know, use the water, harness the water to, you know, make things. And so there were calico mills and shoe mills and all these other mills, and these towns had lots and lots of workers who often came from like Ireland, and you know, sort of just off the boat, and they would come and work there. And they were thriving in a way, except that most of the money was going to mill owners and the kind of the wealthy elite who were running these businesses. And one of them.
Oh, and things have changed so much since then.
Exactly. But one of them was a guy who ran a bunch of the mills, and he was a French-Canadian, and so his name was Robert, was his French-Canadian name. But everyone in the town who kind of both loved and hated him called him Robber, because it looked like Robber. And,
yeah.
And he had given some money to this library, and so with the idea that it would be named after him, and so it was called the Robert Library until he died, and then they changed it to the name of the town, which is Riverton, so it's the Riverton Public Library, but everyone used to refer to it as the Robber's Library.
Oh, wow, that you just never know what the history is, do you?
Now, is Riverton a real town, or is it
I made it up, but okay. I was thinking of a kind of combination of a bunch of different places. Two really in particular. One is Manchester, New Hampshire, which is actually a big city. But if you drive through Manchester, the Connecticut River goes through it, and you can see all of these abandoned mills from the highway. And, you know, just massive structures. So that was kind of in my mind, like what that looks like. And I'd been working on a piece for Smithsonian Magazine and had spent a couple of days driving around Manchester. And so I had kind of what that looked like in my mind. But it was a bigger city. And then I had worked on another piece for the New York Times Magazine. And this was in Braddock, Pennsylvania, which is part of the Rust Belt. It's probably a half an hour, 40 minutes from Pittsburgh. And it also has some water running through it. But its main industry was the steel industry, and there are big steel mills that are also out of business there. Mm-hmm. And this town is just totally, totally falling apart. And it's also the place where Andrew Carnegie built his first library. And so I got to visit that library when I was doing that story.
Well, so interesting, because Fairfield is where Andrew Carnegie built his first library west of the Mississippi.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So this library, I don't know what your library is like, but this library is fascinating because his goal was really to have people who hadn't had the opportunity to have a formal education be able to teach themselves and to become more engaged in the kind of life of the mind, if that. And so he had the library built such that as you left the steel mill, which is across the road, there were tunnels that led from the steel mill to the library under the town. And as you approached the library, there were showers and lockers. And you could take your dirty work clothes off and shower and put on clean clothes and then go up into the library. And the library had not only books, but it had a theater and it had a swimming pool and it had a basketball court and other indoor facilities.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was just this idea that, you know, it would kind of be a value to the whole man in this case. I think mostly men were.
Well, our library here didn't have any of that.
No.
Yeah, it was probably built much later, but, you know, there's something like over 2,000 Carnegie libraries in the world. Most of them are in the United States, but there's some abroad as well. And they really did have the effect of bringing information and knowledge to communities where people might not have, you know, been able to access higher education.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sue Halpern, author of Summer Hours at the Robber's Library. Sue, what do you see as, you know, obviously libraries mean a lot to you, and when you were talking about the little town that you lived in, and the bookmobile couldn't come anymore. I remember the bookmobile and the little town we lived in when I was a child in Pennsylvania. And we had a library in the town, but it was very, very small. And the bookmobile that came from the Lancaster City Library was such a big deal to have that fresh, you know, influx of new books every week or every 2 weeks. When I was a kid, I'm wondering, maybe you too, I always thought I'd be a librarian when I grew up. But
I didn't think I would be a librarian. But I did make my parents join three libraries. So there was a library in our town.
I remember we made a library at home and made my little sister and I and put pockets in the books and library cards and pretended we had a library in our house.
That's kind of hysterical.
I have a library in my house now, actually. All the books I have.
I'm gonna back up a second. Sorry.
Okay, I wanted to ask you, what books did your group decide to start that library with?
Such a good question, because it was a very interesting place that we came to, and a very interesting set of ideas that we came to. So remember I said that it was a very poor community with people doing a lot of seasonal work, and mm-hmm. a lot of times people are on unemployment because it was the wrong season, and so it was a hunting community. There were a lot of folks who did a lot of crafts and that kind of thing, and so when we tried to figure out what we wanted our library to be like, the young man who was to be our librarian said, you know, I don't want the library system just sending us a pile of books. It's not going to work for us because they don't know us. And so what he suggested and what we ended up doing was he and I spent a month going to this place, this big warehouse where the library consortium had all their books. And this took some doing for them to let us do this. But we handpicked over 3,000 books that went into our library when it first opened. And we did that because we wanted people to walk into that room and say, oh, I'm interested in this subject, or I've heard of this thing. And so we just made sure that we had things that we thought would be appealing to a wide variety of the people who lived in the town. And we did. We succeeded.
Said it transformed the town. I thought, well, that had to be amazing that you were able to do that.
Yeah.
How did you know what to pick?
Knew our community, you know, and so we knew that it was important, obviously, to get some new bestseller kind of books, but we also knew that we wanted to have romance novels and crime novels and Western novels. We knew we wanted to have books about hunting. We wanted to have cookbooks. We wanted to have books about crocheting and knitting, and we wanted to have books of patterns of things to make, and we wanted to make sure that the kids section had books that would appeal to lots of different kinds of kids, that kind of thing. So, I mean, it wasn't like we went in there thinking, we know exactly what books we want, but we knew the kind of books that we were looking for and with the kind of assortment that we wanted to provide when we first opened. And the thing is that it was a poor enough town that when the original idea for starting a library was proposed to the town, it was that there would be a tax increase, and it would be something like $3 per person, because how it went. And it got shot down. People thought they didn't want to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew we had a little bit of an uphill battle to get people in the door. However, we ordered 500 library cards because the library consortium folks told us it would take about a year to go through them. There were 1,800 people in our town. And we went through those in 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh!
We went through another 500 by the 6 months in, and by the end of the year, we had given out 1,500 library cards.
Well, obviously, everyone. Good news travels, doesn't it? Because when one person was satisfied, you know, found something, and they said, told their friend, and the friend went, so that's how it goes.
Yeah, and there were also a lot of people there who were related to each other, so that news happened pretty fast. But also, what would happen is people would, who might not think of themselves as readers, would come in with their little kids, let's say, because we had a story hour and we had a nice kid section. So they bring their children in, and while they were waiting for their kids to pick their books, they might start perusing some part of the library and say, hey, you know, maybe I'll try this. And so we were able to kind of hook people in ways in which they might not have realized we were hooking them, and we didn't either, but they would just show up. And we also managed, with our $15,000, to buy out a video store. And the cost.
Oh, boy.
Sorry. And so this video store was going out of business and needed to unload all of its VHS tapes. This is in the olden days. And so we were able to buy them very, very cheaply. And so we had a pretty robust video collection. And so that also brought people in who might not think of themselves as readers. But again, there they were. Their neighbor might say, hey, I just found this really cool book about, you know, house building. You should take a look at it. There's some really cool designs, you know, and things like that. That's how it kind of news traveled.
Yeah.
Well, in
that
summer
was great.
Hours at the Robbers Library, some of the characters come for the books, or some of the visitors to the library come for the books, but others come for other reasons. For, you know, there's almost like a coffee club going on at the library. Of retired gentlemen, and then there are the people who come to use the computers. How do libraries stay relevant in the day and age where most people or a lot of people have access to so much information on their phones or on their laptops?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's happened is people have said, oh, we don't need libraries because, you know, we have the internet. We do have the internet, but it doesn't kind of cover the waterfront. It's useful, but a lot of people like to read books that are physical. They don't like reading online. They don't like reading on their devices. They like having the feel of a book in their hand. So that's one thing. Not everyone has access to the internet, so libraries, particularly in rural communities like the one I came from, or in certain urban areas, provide that service as well. And libraries have adapted in a lot of ways to the current moment. The library that we started not only will let you take out books, they'll let you take out snowshoes. It's a pretty rural, cold, snowy place.
It sounds like it's going back to the Carnegie model.
Yeah, exactly. So, and we're not unusual in that. There are plenty of places that will share things that people might want to use once or twice a year, but they don't want to own or they can't afford to own. So libraries have done that. The other thing is that libraries have always been at the forefront of educating new Americans. People who have just come to this country and want to learn, you know, want to become citizens, and so they need to go to citizenship classes. Those have historically been held at libraries, as have ESL classes, as have adult literacy classes. So those all kind of continue. In the library that I started, there's a knitting club. And there's a book club. And there was a theater group and a play reading group, and that actually moved across the street when a very wealthy summer resident donated the money to build an art center. And that art center was generated essentially by our little library, because he saw what was happening with the library and how popular it was, and he saw this play reading group, and he thought, huh, they need a theater. And so he built one.
Wow.
So it literally changed the physical landscape of our town. And now in that space, there are music concerts from both local musicians and from outside people. And there are art exhibits, and there are plays, and there's a dance group. I mean, there's just all this stuff going on. And it all started because people started reading plays at the library.
Wow. That is really interesting.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
You talked about a knitter's group, and you made sure that there were some books about knitting in your first purchase, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely. And so we really just tried to figure out who would show up at the library and why would they be there. And that really helped. And once, you know, I remember our neighbor who was, I think at that point, probably in her 80s, she was a big quilter. There's a lot of quilting that goes on in cold places. And she was a big quilter, and she came to the library opening, and she was shocked that we had all these quilting books there. And she took a bunch out, and no doubt she went back to her quilting group. It was like, hey, look what I found. And so then, of course, all the quilting ladies would come, and we could order books from Interlibrary Loan for them. So, you know, people found out that it wasn't a static thing. It wasn't like we only had these books, and you know, a year later we'd still only have those books. That's not how it worked.
That's an amazing story.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Sue Halpern, author of Summer Hours at the Robbers Library. Now, this book has an element of mystery. In fact, all three characters, there's some mystery in their lives. Certainly with Kit, there is, to the reader, we don't know what it is that she was running from for a long time. With Sunny, the mystery, she doesn't know. None of us, you know, the readers nor the character know this mystery in her life. Rusty, he's trying to uncover a mystery. He's investigating something that may be a mystery, but he's really not sure. So did you have all of these sort of plot lines from the very beginning, or did some of them develop as you wrote?
I knew what Kit was running from because I wanted her to come out the other side, you know, with these two people, other people, these other characters, kind of by her side. So I knew that. I knew Sunny's parents were unusual. I didn't know completely, like, what they had done to what this mystery was, but I knew there was something there. It wasn't quite there yet. And Rusty, I had to get him out of New York. I had to get him to New Hampshire. There had to be a good reason. And so it was this mystery that you allude to. So I knew about that as well. What I didn't know with Rusty was whether he'd figure it out, whether he would solve that mystery. I knew that Kit would, and I knew that Sunny would kind of grow up. But but with Rusty, I just wasn't sure at the beginning whether he would have a kind of what his revelation would be. And so it was kind of fun to realize what it would be when I finally did.
Yeah, Rusty was a bit kind of on a treasure hunt, really.
Yes. Yeah. So he had lost everything pretty much in this financial downturn, and he just wasn't able to get another job, which happened to a lot of people. And he really had no other skills other than kind of making money out of money. You know, he was just really down on his luck, and he found this bank book from when his mom had died, And it was, at the time, it was so inconsequential to him because he was making so much money. But now that he was had no money, he kind of looked at it and he thought, huh, if I can get this money from this bank that has been in the bank since like 1950, I'll be rich. Or at least I'll be richer than I am right now, which is I have no money. So yes, he goes off looking for the bank and tries wanting to get the money back.
And I didn't expect that would be as hard as it turned out to be.
It is hard. I mean, I think, you know, the internet does make it a little easier. But, you know, people, you have to apply and, you know, this is hard to find. And in his case, in a town like Riverton that at one point had been thriving and now wasn't, a lot of the businesses, including the banks, had gone out of business. So what happens to your money then? You know, and it's hard to sort that out.
Well, even today, I mean, I had a question from my bank, and I called, and I had to speak to somebody in Idaho.
Yeah, exactly.
My local bank does not take calls. I couldn't believe it.
That's, you know, crazy, but that's...
It is.
Now, Sue, I noticed in the bio on the back of on the back cover of your book that you know, your husband Bill McKibben, who's a fairly well known writer and environmental activist. Sonny's parents are environmental activists to the extreme. So was your husband an inspiration for their characters in any way?
Well, that's an interesting question. Well, they are like animal activists, I would say, which he's not.
Okay.
So that's a difference. And they are really extreme.
yes.
But
yes,
I would say that in knowing Bill, I certainly have come to know a lot of people, you know, who are kind of like those people, like Sonny's parents. Mm-hmm. They're not part of, say, the groups that he's part of, but you just sort of, you know, it's in the air. You sort of see them. And also, I live in Vermont, which is a home to a lot of people who do live off the grid and who are vegans and who are really very serious about their kind of politics and their environmentalism. And so, you know, I see those people, they, you know, shop at the co-op, and so do I, for instance. And so a lot of that was just sort of percolating in my mind. But I've also read all those stories about PETA activists who go around and throw paint on people who are wearing fur and, you know, who do all sorts of, actions to bring to light, you know, the issues that they care deeply about. So that was all in my mind, but I would say that Bill has exposed me to a wide variety of activists.
So does being married to another writer make it easier for you to be a writer as your career, or more challenging, because if you're both on deadline, then who does the dishes?
I think kind of both, actually. In general, I think, I mean, first of all, it's been so long that I don't think we think of it too much, but, and it certainly was much harder when we were raising a child, because most of that fell to me, those responsibilities. But, one of the nice things is that we can read each other's work and, you know, have kind of an in-house editor, or if we're stuck on something, you know, have a conversation about it. So that's really, really nice. And I think that a lot of people, you know, just don't have that, or they have to rely on their writers groups or on their friends, and maybe they feel a little, you know, uncomfortable just saying, can you please read this right now, right this second, because I'm having trouble with it. So that makes it easier. I think the harder part is just, it's like coordinating schedules and, making sure that, you know, we're not both out and about for too long a time when we don't see each other and that kind of stuff.
Are you ever competitive about whose book sells more or anything
well,
like that?
Well, if we were competitive about that, I would lose. So, the thing is that I'm married to a kind of freak of nature in that he writes so fast and so well so fast that if I spent much time thinking about it, which I do sometimes, but if I spent a lot of time thinking about it, I would never want to write another word. So, like, in the course of me writing one piece of journalism, he might write 10. He'll say things like, I might go out to walk the dog. This actually happened yesterday. I went out to walk the dog. I walked the dog for about half an hour. And Bill said, I just wrote this little piece for The Guardian. Okay. I walked the dog, and you wrote a piece for The Guardian. I see. That's how it's going to go. So, I mean, I sort of gave up thinking in those terms because not only, you know, is it counterproductive, but, I mean, he's unlike anybody else, I think, on the planet. And so, you know, you just can't really compare yourself to that. I mean, I've written 7 books, which I think is a lot of books. He's written 13.
It is.
He's written 13, and he's on his 14th.
Wow. And are all of his nonfiction?
No. Actually, his first book of fiction came out last year.
Oh, so maybe he was inspired by you.
We were doing it at the same time, which I thought was really funny. No, I don't think so. I think we were just both kind of in the mood to kind of entertain ourselves. And so we were, you know, doing that. And so that was fun. But now we're both, right at the moment, both doing some nonfiction writing.
Well, you know, I think beginning writers are like this program because they can learn from the writers. And I think they would like to know, do you have the characters formed at the beginning, or do they develop as you progress with the plot?
They definitely develop. And I think that what happens is that you sort of start, you wind them up a little bit, and then they take on a life of their own. And so then they start talking to you. I know that there are some people who find it much easier and more reassuring to kind of come up with a very detailed outline of plot and character, and you know, more power to them. I can't really do that. I'm not very good at that because I find that the characters want to explain themselves as the process goes along, and I feel like I need to be open to that. Someone asked me the other day sort of what the difference between writing fiction and nonfiction was, and I think that one of the differences is that in fiction, the characters talk to you, and they tell you things, and you're sort of transcribing. And in nonfiction, you're really talking to yourself. You're saying, how should I say this thing that I need to say?
Sure.
That is based in fact. And so that conversation is about you, and the other conversation is about them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sue Halpern, author of Summer Hours at the Robbers Library. Sue, would you like to read from the book for us?
Sure. Did you have a specific place, or do you want me just to pick? Or?
Just pick.
Okay. One of my favorite parts is Sunny. Mm-hmm. And I like this particular section because Sunny just makes me laugh. She's such a kind of character. I mean, that's the only way to describe her. And one of the things I did in the book was put her all in the first person so we could really hear her voice. So this is a section in the very beginning, sort of about 20 pages in. And it's her section in the first person. I'll just read part of it. So in our county, they have this thing called Kids Court, which is how I ended up at the library for summer vacation, even though I don't have summer vacation since I'm no-schooled. No-schooling is what it sounds like. You don't go to regular school or follow a curriculum. The idea is that the whole world is one big school, and you can learn biology from looking at frogs and worms, you can learn fractions from making pies, and you can learn history from talking to old people. But you don't have to. You study only what interests you. No schooling is about awakening your passions and following down whatever path they lead, my mother likes to say. It's also basically my parents' philosophy of life. The two of them met at a rainbow gathering, and when it was over, they hitchhiked for a couple of years, crisscrossing North and South America, stopping to barter or do odd jobs when they needed food or cash. Kids' court is a real court with a real judge and a sheriff who yells, "All rise," when a judge walks into the room. Though from what I could see, this was less about getting people to stand up and more about the fact that kids' court starts at 6:45 in the morning so parents can get to work afterward and everyone is really sleepy. It's the place where good kids, or kids who haven't yet gone bad, are sent when they do something wrong or dumb or both, like try to slip a book down their jeans at Barnes & Noble when they're sure no one is looking. The book cost $22.95, which was $12.63, more than I had on me at the time. "Well, Solstice," the judge said, looking down at the papers on his desk before he looked at me. He was a black man with a round face and round wire-rimmed glasses, whose head was completely bald and shiny on top, and whose chin was decorated with a woolly gray beard that sprung off his face like coils of steel wool. "Sonny," I said, my right leg shaking nervously. "When I'm nervous, I have a tendency to butt in." "Excuse me?" The judge frowned, making it clear that he was not pleased to have heard from me so soon. "Solstice is the name on my birth certificate," I continued, speaking quickly. "It's my official name, but everyone calls me Sonny." I smiled at the judge. He did not smile back. "Solstice," the judge began again, "can you tell me why you stole?" He looked down at his papers, squinted, and then cocked his head, the way dogs do sometimes when they're confused. "The Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary?" "Okay, easy question." "Because I didn't have enough money to buy it," I said. People laughed, but I wasn't trying to be funny. I would have bought it if I could. "Order," he growled, and threatened to bang his gavel. "I understand that's why you stole. But why did you steal a dictionary of all things? I've had a lot of thieves in my courtroom, but this is a first." "The thing is, I could afford the paperback, but paperbacks don't last. Their pages fall out, and what good is a dictionary that is missing a page now and then? You go to look up a word, and it isn't there, and you can't prove it ever was. The hardback was solid and sturdy, and it was beautiful, with gilt edging, which made the book itself look 24 carat-ish. Did I say that my mother makes jewelry that she sells at a kiosk in the mall? The same mall where I sucked in my stomach and tried to cram a 532-page book between my belly and the waistband of my jeans? "I'm waiting," the judge said, startling me. "Okay," I said, inhaling deeply. I was tired of always having to ask someone when I didn't know the meaning of a word, like sesquipedalian. "Which means," the judge said. "That's the thing," I said. "I don't know." That's it.
She was an interesting character. She really was.
Yeah, she's got a lot of ideas. Sonny does.
She's not afraid to speak up, you know, which is good.
No, because I think she grew up surrounded by mostly by adults, and you know, she's an only child, so she's got that kind of, you know, adult-ish aspect to her. She's, you know, she just, and she has ideas, and she wants to express them, and she's funny.
Now, were you sad to leave any of these characters when you were finished writing the book?
I was sad to leave them all, although I feel like they're going to be okay, and they're going to, you know, the book ends with them having dinner together, and it's kind of a nice image to leave them at.
Yes. Well, they all ended up better than they started.
Right, which was the point.
Yes,
And which I think too often, I think in books, that doesn't happen, you know. And I really wanted to write something that was positive and would make you feel relatively okay at the end, actually good, and understanding that bad things can happen to people, and yet the spirit that can carry them through them, you know, can leave them in, if not a better place, definitely an okay place. And that life goes on and people will find their way. I mean, obviously that's not true for everybody, but I think it's true for a lot of people, and it's a good reminder, you know, when you're going through a tough time that, that, you know, these little tiny incremental things that happen to you along the way are, you know, are cumulative and they help.
Right, right. It seems like for this type of book, you probably didn't have to do much research, whereas most of your other books, as looking through your website, have a lot of research involved.
Yes. So true. yes.
It seems like some writers really, really love the research part, almost more than the writing part.
Yeah, I'm not that person, but, you know, I'm a good researcher, and, you know, because as you most noted in the very beginning, I, you know, did spend a fair amount of time going to school, and if nothing else, I think you learn how to be a good researcher, but, and that's really what also being a reporter is. Being a reporter is being able to, you know, find the people that you need to talk to and find the articles and the books that you need to read. I think one of the reliefs I had at writing this book was that I didn't have to do a lot of research. I had written a book, two books before this one, about memory. And so I had to spend a lot of time learning the language of neuroscience. And I spent, I think, 5 years on that book.
Oh, wow.
I spent 2 years, maybe even 3 years, hanging out with this group of neurologists and neuroscientists at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. It's a research group of about 120 people. And I just did that because I needed to learn the language and I needed to learn kind of what they were doing. But I couldn't really learn what they were doing. I couldn't understand what they were doing until I really understood their language, which took, you know, a couple of years.
How do you know when you start a project like that, that you're, I mean, did you have any idea that it was going to be 5 years of your life? And were you so interested in the subject that if you'd known that, you'd say, yep, I'll devote 5 years of my life to this?
No and no. but... different things would sort of happened along the way. For instance, in the middle of that, I realized that there was this great story staring me in the face, a story about the genetics of Alzheimer's disease. And so I pitched that story to the New Yorker, and they went for it. And so I kind of had about a 8-month detour from writing the book to doing the research for that piece and writing that piece. So, and that was a great opportunity, you know, and I wouldn't have had that opportunity if I hadn't been on the ground in that place.
Uh-huh.
And I also think, although it's true, I, you know, if someone said this is going to take 5 years, I probably would have just said, forget it. I learned a ton. And it became in a funny way the genesis of my book A Dog Walks Into a Nursing Home, because
I wondered if that was the one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I had this most wonderful dog, and I decided that we would become a therapy dog team to work at our local nursing home. I thought that would be interesting for both of us. And she was pretty bored, I would say. And so this was just going to be a good thing. And when I first imagined that we would do that, I thought, well, you know, I've spent a lot of time now with dementia patients, and I've spent a lot of time in a hospital, and I've spent a lot of time in memory care units, and I thought, we'll just volunteer to work with that population. And that was in my mind, because I thought, well, hey, you know, I just wrote this book, and so I'm kind of like a little bit of an expert, and of course they're going to want us. And, you know, I had all these fantasies about how this was going to go, and they were all dashed when I was told that they didn't need anyone at the memory care unit. They needed someone to work with the general population of the nursing home, and that freaked me out a little bit. And it turned out to be a truly great, great experience that we had for 7 years.
And a book came out of that. But when you started, did you think, oh, I'm going to do this and write a book about it?
I didn't, because I couldn't figure out. I mean, I certainly, my reporter's nose was twitching when I went there, because I thought, I wonder if there is a book to be written here. But it took about a couple of years, when I was there to sort of figure out what that book might be. And it certainly wasn't the book I would have imagined going into it. But, when I did go, after a certain point of being there for a little while, things were so interesting to me that I did take notes. I would write stuff down after I left, the conversations that I'd had with people, things that happened, things the dog did, things, interactions people had with the dog. So I had all of those notes. I had, you know, probably 30,000 words of notes or something after a couple of years.
Wow.
So that helped. It helped
so
when
the writer, the reporter is always on.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And I mean, you know, it's easy to be lazy, but I did think, but I had this like mess of notes, but they were just a mess of notes. They didn't really mean anything. Like I didn't know how to structure that or make it a book or make it interesting or anything like that. So that was the hard part. Having the raw material was useful because I could go back and consult with it. And that is actually something really I found interesting. Like people, we always think we're going to remember the, you know, the details of things, and we never do, almost never. And so,
writing isn't that the truth? Last night I put something somewhere, and I'm like, I'm going to remember where I put this, and now I'm thinking, you know, I better take a picture of it on my phone.
Yes, exactly. Great thing. But we just don't remember. And so writing things down, I remember when I was working on this story for the New Yorker, and remember I said it, you know, it's like the reporting was like over probably about 8 months. And one of the things I had done was go to the Dominican Republic with this research group, and we were there for about a week. And in the course of that, you know, I was helping them, not only doing my work, but sort of helping them as I could. But we had visited this man, who had very severe dementia, and, in his house. And I had forgotten this, what I thought was just such an interesting detail when I went back and looked at my notebook later, that he was lying in this house that was one room with a corrugated steel roof and, you know, pretty lowly, and, you know, domicile. He had smiley face sheets on his bed.
Oh.
And it was just such a like great image, and I totally forgot it.
Wow. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, because this has been such a great conversation. And
oh, it has.
And
I'd it
love,
has.
To, love to keep going. But, Mom, do you have some final words for us?
Oh, gosh, you know what? I had on page 324 of the book, I had put an asterisk on some something I wanted to quote.
Okay,
so,
well, I can read it since I'm the one holding
the book.
You looked
that up because, yeah.
Yeah, 324. Yeah. There's quotes throughout here. But this is actually from the text of the book.
Yeah.
Everyone's life is an unfolding story, and all stories have good guys and bad guys, and all stories have conflicts and resolutions, and all stories, if they're interesting, have drama.
Right. I thought that was perfect for this book.
So we will end there and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for being with us, Sue.
This was really fun.
It was great.